Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today, we are tackling what might just be the single biggest question a human being can ask.
Oh, no pressure then.
No pressure at all. It's the question that, you know, it keeps philosophers staring at the ceiling at night. It drives neuroscientists absolutely crazy. And frankly, it's probably the thing you're obsessing over when you wake up at 3 a.m. and just cannot get back to sleep.
Right.
The question is simply, who exactly are you?
It is the ultimate mystery, isn't it? The mystery of the self.
Exactly. And I don't mean the stuff you put on a tax form.
Right. Not the legal definition.
You know, not your name, your job title, or your social security number. I mean, what is the stuff that makes you you? Is it that little voice in your head that's always narrating your day?
The one that says, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that second donut.
Or I really nailed that presentation. Is it your memories, your childhood? Is it your physical body? Or is it something else entirely?
It's fascinating because depending on who you ask, you get a completely different and often contradictory answer. You ask a philosopher, they might talk about the subject of experience, this you know, entity that witnesses the world. Then you ask a neuroscientist, and they'll point to neural networks firing in the cortex, specifically the default mode network.
Right, the brain stuff.
And then if you ask a monk or a spiritual teacher, they might just tell you the self is an illusion. It's a trick of the mind that we need to wake up from.
And the problem is, none of those answers seem to talk to each other. It feels completely fragmented.
It does.
You've got the biology over here, the psychology over there, and spirituality somewhere off in the clouds. And more importantly, for regular people like you and me, those definitions don't really explain why the self feels so fragile sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why does my sense of me, my patience, my values, my whole personality, why does it completely crumble when I haven't slept in 24 hours?
That's a great point. We like to think our personality is this stable rock.
But it's not.
But a bad night's sleep proves otherwise.
Exact. Or why can't I just think my way out of burnout? You hear that all the time.
Just change your mindset.
Right. If the self is just my thoughts, why can't I just think different thoughts and be fine? Why does my body sometimes scream no when my mind is saying go, go, go?
And that tension you're describing, that conflict between what we think we are and what we actually experience, that's the core of what we're digging into today.
Okay.
We tend to think of the self as a noun, a thing, a statue. You know, the ghost in the machine that drives the body around like a car.
Right.
But today's deep dive is going to flip that on its head. We're looking at this fascinating white paper that argues the self isn't a thing at all. And it's not an illusion either. It's a stack.
A stack, like a tech stack or a stack of pancakes.
A bit more like a tech stack, actually. The source material for today is a white paper titled The Self as a Viability Stack, From Mitochondrial Proto-Subjectivity to Narrative Identity.
That's a mouthful.
It is, but it's worth it. It's by Dr. Bachara C. Hilly, an internal medicine physician, and he wrote it with his AI research partner.
Oh, that's interesting.
And what I love about this is that Dr. Sinkeli isn't just looking at this from some ivory tower or a philosophy department. He's a clinician. He deals with chronic disease, metabolic health, burnout, the, you know, the messiness of real human bodies every single day.
So he's on the front lines, bridging the gap between the biology, the philosophy, and systems theory. He's looking at the whole picture.
Exactly. From the cell to the soul, as you said.
Yeah.
And his central idea is that the self is a viability stack.
Yeah.
It's a layered architecture of interfaces designed to do one thing and one thing only, keep you alive. Or, more specifically, to keep you viable under uncertainty.
Okay, let's unpack this viability stack concept because it sounds huge. When I was reading through this, the analogy that popped into my head was a big corporation, a corporate hierarchy.
That's a great way to visualize it. Yeah, let's run with that.
So imagine this massive corporation. You've got the CEO up in the penthouse office. That's our brain, right?
Yeah.
Specifically the cortex, the conscious thinking part.
The one giving the interviews and writing the mission statement.
Exactly. But then you've got the factory floor, you know, the basement levels where the actual work gets done. And that factory floor knows things, fundamental survival level things that the CEO literally cannot comprehend.
Right. The CEO has never been on the factory floor.
Never. But the CEO has to make all the big decisions based on these little reports that come up from the floor.
That is exactly the dynamic. And in this model, the factory floor is your cells, and even more specifically, your mitochondria.
The powerhouse of the cell.
The powerhouse, yes. So the factory floor knows things like, are we running out of fuel? Or is the building on fire? Or are the workers completely exhausted? The CEO, the brain, it doesn't feel the heat of the furnace directly. It just gets a memo, a report.
And based on that memo, the CEO makes a public statement. Things are great.
Exactly. But, and here's the kicker, if those reports from the basement are screaming, "We're out of fuel, shut it down," the CEO can't just spin a positive PR story and fix it.
No.
The CEO can lie to the press. They can say production is at an all-time high.
Yeah.
But the factory will still grind to a halt.
It's a biological reality.
Exactly. And that's where the self gets so misunderstood in modern society. We spend all our time focusing on the CEO, the narrative, the psychology, the mindset, and we completely ignore the factory floor until it goes on strike.
Which is what we call burnout.
Or a breakdown. So today we are going to climb this stack. We're going to go from the absolute bottom, the microscopic level, all the way to the top.
I'm ready. What's the roadmap?
Okay, we're going to start with the proto-self, which is where we find out that your mitochondria are pretty much running the show.
Okay.
Then we'll move up to the core self, which is where chemistry turns into feeling. Then up again to the autobiographical self, the storyteller in your brain.
The CEO.
The CEO. And finally, we're going to look at what happens when this stack breaks, which re-explains things like trauma and burnout, and how ancient systems like traditional Chinese medicine might have actually been right all along about how to fix it.
I love it when we get to vindicate ancient wisdom with modern biology. It feels like closing a loop.
It really does.
Okay, let's dive in. Section one, the foundation. We need to define this word viability because the paper makes a very specific point. Biology doesn't care about happiness.
No, not in the slightest. Biology is ruthless. It cares about one thing, viability. And viability is more than just not dying in this exact second.
It's more of a long-term strategy.
It's about maintaining a bounded, coherent organization in a world that is essentially chaotic and trying to tear you apart. I mean, it means keeping a massive number of variables within a very safe range. Temperature, energy, oxygen, hydration, salt balance, redox state. The list goes on.
The paper calls this constraint satisfaction.
Right. And think about it like this. Life isn't about optimizing one single thing. We hear that advice all the time, right? Maximize your happiness, maximize your productivity.
Maximize your gains at the gym.
All of that. But a biological system can't just maximize one variable at the expense of others. It's about not failing at 20 essential things at the same time.
That's a huge mental shift. It's not about winning. It's about not losing.
Exactly. If your temperature goes too high, you die. If your oxygen goes too low, you die. If your blood becomes too acidic, you die. Viability is the art of staying inside all those safety rails simultaneously. It's this constant dynamic balancing act.
So the foundation of the self isn't, I think, therefore I am. It's more like, I am staying within my safety rails, therefore I am.
That's a much better way of putting it. If you lose that boundary, you cease to be a self, and you just become a pile of disorganized chemistry.
Okay.
And this brings us to the first layer of the stack, the proto-self. Mm-hmm. Now, this concept actually builds on the work of Antonio Damasio, a really famous neuroscientist. He proposed three selves, proto, core, and autobiographical.
Right.
But Dr. Saley takes Damasio's idea and he anchors it physically.
Damasio said the proto-self is like a living map of the body, right? It's constantly running in the background, but we don't consciously feel it.
Correct. It is pre-phenomenal. That's a fancy way of saying you aren't consciously aware of it. You don't sit there and monitor your blood pH level.
I hope not. That sounds stressful.
You don't feel your liver filtering toxins or your pancreas releasing insulin. But that map exists. The system knows these things. And if that map disappears, or if the territory it's mapping collapses, you're dead.
Simple as that.
Now, here is the twist in the paper that I found absolutely fascinating. Dr. Saheeli argues that this proto-self isn't just a neural map in the brainstem. It is literally grounded in your mitochondria.
This was the aha moment for me when I read it. I haven't really thought about mitochondria since, what, high school biology?
The powerhouse of the cell.
Yeah, that's the meme, right? We just think of them as these little batteries or generators humming away in the background.
It's the meme, but it's a massive oversimplification. And honestly, it does them a huge disservice. This paper references the work of Martin Picard in this emerging field of mitochondrial psychobiology.
Okay.
And Picard argues that mitochondria aren't just dumb power plants. They are sensors. They are social.
Yeah.
They actually communicate with each other across the entire body.
Wait. Mitochondria are social. What does that even mean?
In a way, yes. You have to remember, mitochondria were originally their own organisms. They were bacteria that merged with our cells billions of years ago. They have their own DNA.
Right. They're not originally us.
They're not. they behave like a colony.
Yeah.
And they're constantly detecting things. They detect energy availability, they detect stress, and they detect what's called inflammatory load.
Mm.
They are constantly sniffing the environment inside and outside the cell.
So you're telling me that my mitochondria are down there, inside my cells, trillions of them, and they're essentially holding a vote on whether I'm safe or not.
That is a perfect way to put it. They are holding a continuous, real-time vote on your viability. They're checking, do we have enough energy to go hunt? Do we have enough energy to fight off this virus? Is the environment safe? And if that vote comes back negative, if the factory floor says no, they send a signal up the chain of command.
Which brings us to one of the most important concepts in the whole paper, one that I think explains so much about modern fatigue, the language of non-negotiability. How does the body say stop?
Yes. This is crucial. The body doesn't send a polite email saying, hey, please consider resting if you have time in your schedule.
That would be nice, but no.
It uses chemistry to enforce a mandate.
The paper talks about something called mitokines, and one in particular, GDF-15.
GDF-15. If there is one molecule to remember from this entire deep dive, it's this one, growth differentiation factor 15. This is a signaling molecule that gets released by mitochondria when they are under stress.
And what does it do?
Dr. Sakili calls it a global stop signal.
A global stop signal. So what happens when this stuff hits my bloodstream?
When GDF-15 levels rise in your blood, it travels to a very specific part of your brainstem, the area postrema, and it dictates a very specific set of behaviors.
Okay.
It suppresses your appetite. It absolutely kills your motivation. It makes you want to just curl up in a ball and not move. It reduces your desire to explore or socialize or do anything new.
Wait a second. That sounds exactly like having the flu or severe burnout or even deep depression.
Exactly. Think about the last time you had a really bad flu. You weren't lying in bed thinking, oh, I'm just feeling a bit lazy today. Maybe I should work on my mindset.
No, not at all.
You felt a deep physical prohibition against movement. The very idea of walking to the kitchen felt like climbing Mount Everest. That is GDF-15 talking. It's your mitochondria saying, we do not have the resources to move. Stop. Conserve. Repair.
And the key takeaway here is that this is non-negotiable.
That's the critical point. You cannot mindset your way out of high GDF-15. You can't listen to a motivational speaker or go to a Tony Robbins event and override a mitochondrial stop signal.
Or at least not for long.
Not for long. You can try, but you'll break something. This is the biological root of that phrase. I literally can't.
That is so validating because in our culture, we're obsessed with mind over matter. We think if we just push harder, drink more coffee, hustle more, we can overcome anything.
Right. No pain, no gain.
But this paper is saying, actually, no. There's a hard floor, a biological reality. If your mitochondria say stop and you keep pushing, you are breaking the stack.
And this becomes incredibly relevant as we age.
Mm.
The paper discusses this concept of the coherence margin. Think of it like your safety buffer, your reserve tank.
Okay.
As we get older, or if we have a chronic illness, our mitochondrial efficiency drops. That margin shrinks. So the protocell, the mitochondria, starts restricting your agency to keep you safe.
It's a protective mechanism.
It's purely protective. It says, you know what? You can't go for that long run today, or you can't handle that stressful meeting. It's not a loss of will. It's a preservation of viability.
So the proto-self is the silent partner in the boardroom who actually holds all the veto power.
Precisely. It decides what is possible. The brain just gets to decide what to choose from the very limited menu of options that are left.
Wow.
If the proto-self says running is not possible, the brain can only choose between sleep and lie on the couch and watch Netflix.
That is a game changer for how we view laziness, or what we call laziness. Okay, so that's the basement level, the factory floor. It's silent, it's metabolic, it's mitochondrial. But, and this is the big question, if it's all silent, how do we end up feeling happy or sad? How does a chemical signal turn into the feeling of I'm excited or I'm terrified?
This takes us to section 2, the interface. This is the translation layer. How chemistry becomes feeling.
The paper calls it the interface.
Right. An interface is a translation between two different systems, like translating the keystrokes on your laptop into pixels on a screen.
Okay.
Here, we are translating a cellular need, like I need glucose, into a nervous system action. I feel hungry.
And the messengers here are what the paper calls molecules of emotion. And this is referencing the work of Candace Pert.
Candace Pert was a revolutionary in neuroscience back in the 70s and 80s. She discovered the opiate receptor, which was huge. But her bigger contribution was realizing that neuropeptides, these little chemical messengers, They aren't just in the brain.
They're everywhere.
They are everywhere. In your gut, your immune system, your heart, your connective tissue. She famously called the body a mobile brain.
And the paper breaks down a hierarchy of these signals, which I found really helpful because often we just hear hormones and we think that covers everything.
Right. It's not just one big soup of chemicals. There are levels, and understanding the levels helps us understand ourselves.
Okay. What's at the top?
At the top, you have neuropeptides. These are fast. They create felt effect emotions. This is the feeling of a sudden rush of fear or a burst of joy or a pang of sadness. They are the immediate news updates.
The breaking news alerts.
Exactly. Then below that, you have hormones. These are slower. They're more like policy setters.
So not the news alert, but like the government declaring we are now at wartime.
That's a perfect analogy. Cortisol doesn't give you a specific thought. It shifts the entire economy of your body into a high alert state. It changes the baseline priorities. It says, don't bother building muscle right now. Burn sugar. Don't digest your food. Look for threats.
Okay, what's next?
Then you have cytokines. These are immune signals. They provide context, and usually that context is malaise or sickness behavior.
That feeling of just blah.
Yes, that vague sense of, I just don't feel right. That's cytokines interacting with your nervous system. And finally, at the very bottom, you have the mitokines we just talked about, like GDF-15. That's the hard floor, the non-negotiable viability limits.
So when the proto-self, the cells, gets perturbed or disturbed by the world, it releases these chemicals, and that generates the next level up. The core self.
Yes. The core self is a result of the proto-self meeting the world. And the paper defines the core self as being transient and compulsory.
Compulsory meaning you don't have a choice.
You have zero choice. You have to feel it. If you touch a hot stove, the pain isn't a suggestion. It's not a polite request.
Right.
It's a command. The core self is the feeling of being affected right now.
Yeah.
It is the raw feeling of I am. It's the feeling of existing inside a body that is reacting to the world.
Now, here is where the paper challenges a really big myth. And I think most people, myself included, assume that consciousness, the feeling of me, happens in the cortex. You know, the big, wrinkly, smart part of the human brain.
The part that does calculus and writes poetry.
Exactly. That's where we do our thinking.
That is the cortical fallacy.
Yeah.
We assume that because thinking happens there, feeling must happen there too. But the paper argues very strongly against this. It says consciousness does not start in the cortex. It starts much, much lower in the brainstem.
A brainstem, the so-called lizard brain.
The lizard brain, essentially. And the paper cites two huge figures here, Mark Solms and Jake Panksepp. Mark Solms has this brilliant definition of consciousness. He calls it felt homeostatic error.
Felt homeostatic error. That's a mouthful. Let's unpack that because it sounds really important.
It's absolutely fundamental.
Yeah.
So homeostasis is your body's attempt to stay balanced, right? It wants to stay at 98.6 degrees. It wants a certain oxygen level.
The safety rails.
The safety rails. Error is when you drift away from that balance. You're too hot, too cold, too hungry, too threatened. Solms argues that consciousness itself arises because you need to feel that error in order to fix it.
So you care about it.
You have to care. A computer can have an error code and not care. It just flashes a little light. But a living thing needs to feel bad, so it does something to stop the badness.
So we don't have feelings because they're poetic or romantic. We have them because they are authoritative.
That is the perfect word, authoritative. A feeling is a compressed data packet that is screaming, act now. You can argue with a thought. You can sit there and debate. Is this the right career for me? Is this person right for me? For years.
I've done that.
We all have. But you can't argue with a stomachache. You cannot argue with a panic attack. You cannot argue with the feeling of suffocation.
It's the difference between receiving a memo that you can ignore and hearing a fire alarm blaring in your ear.
Exactly. The core self is the fire alarm. And Jake Panksepp, he mapped this out even further. He identified these primary emotional systems that are deep in the brainstem, and they're shared by all mammals.
These aren't human things.
Not at all. Seeking, fear, rage, care, panic, grief, and play. These aren't learned behaviors. You don't learn how to feel fear. It's hardwired into the system from birth.
So let me see if I've got this straight. The core self is this. My mitochondria, the proto-self, they detect a threat in the environment. They send signals up to the brainstem. The brainstem lights up the fear system, and suddenly I feel afraid. That is the core self emerging.
Yes. And notice we haven't even touched the cortex yet. We haven't told a story about why we're afraid. We just are.
Which brings us to the penthouse. Section 3, the autobiographical self. This is where the storyteller lives. This is where we usually think we live.
This is the layer we are most familiar with, for sure.
Yeah.
The autobiographical self. It's the layer of memory, identity, and time. It takes that raw feeling from the core self, that feeling of, I feel bad, and it extends it into the past and the future.
It gives it a narrative.
It gives it a narrative. It turns, I feel fear, into, I'm an anxious person because my mother didn't love me enough.
That's a big jump.
It is.
Yeah.
But that's what the cortex does so well. It binds feelings to time. It creates a story arc. It desperately tries to make sense of the raw data coming up from below.
The paper talks about three key brain networks here. The salience network, the default mode network, and the frontoparietal network.
All right. You could think of them as the executive staff up in the penthouse. The salience network is the gatekeeper. It's continuously scanning all the inputs from the body and the world, and it decides what is important enough to bother the CEO with.
He's the filter, like, hey, boss, stomach is growling. You should probably pay attention to that.
Hey, boss, your toe itches. Ignore that. It's not important right now.
Right.
Then you have the default mode network, or DMN. This is the storyteller. It creates the narrative of me. It stitches together your memories and your self-image. It's the network that's active when you're daydreaming or ruminating or thinking about yourself. This is the voice in your head.
And the frontoparietal network.
That's the executive planner, the project manager.
Yeah.
Once the DMN has a story, this network figures out how to achieve the goals of that story. Okay, we are a hungry person. How do we get to the fridge? What are the rules? Can we eat this?
Okay, but here's the catch. The paper calls this the great asymmetry. And this blew my mind because I think I live my entire life pretending this isn't true.
This is probably the most critical point for understanding human behavior in the entire paper. The autobiographical self, the penthouse, the CEO, it interprets value, but it does not generate it.
So value comes from the bottom.
Value comes from the bottom.
Yeah.
Every single time. Value is determined by viability. The cortex, you know, it can come up with a brilliant plan to work 80 hours a week to get a promotion.
Sure.
The cortex thinks that's high value because of social status or money or ego. But if the mitochondria, the proto self, are saying we will literally die if we do this, there's a fundamental conflict.
And who wins that conflict?
The bottom always wins eventually.
Yeah.
But the cortex can lie to itself for a surprisingly long time.
And that's what the paper calls the lying narrative.
Yes. The brain creates a story. I'm fine. I just need another coffee. I'm tough. I can push through this. Sleep is for the weak.
We've all told ourselves that story.
We all have.
Yeah.
This narrative directly contradicts the biological reality.
Yeah.
The GDF-15 levels that are screaming, stop.
It's like a press secretary spinning a positive story while the economy is collapsing. The fundamentals of our economy are strong. Meanwhile, the banks are all closing their doors.
That is a perfect analogy. And this is where modern life traps us. We live almost entirely in our autobiographical self. We live in the story, we identify with the story, and we learn to ignore the signals from the core and proto layers until the factory floor pulls the emergency brake.
And that emergency brake is what we call burnout or breakdown.
Exactly.
This leads us perfectly into section 4. Because sometimes the stack doesn't just get stressed, it breaks. We need to talk about trauma, because the way this paper frames trauma is different from anything I read before.
Yes. It offers a really fresh and I think much more useful definition.
Mm-hmm.
It says trauma is not just a memory problem or a psychological issue. It is an interface injury.
An interface injury. That sounds so mechanical, like a wire has been cut between two components.
It implies a breakdown in communication between the layers of the stack. When you experience something truly overwhelming, something that threatens your viability in a profound way, the system is forced into a survival mode. It locks down.
The paper calls this the lock-in.
Right. Imagine a threat is so high that the proto-self is just screaming danger at the top of its lungs. The core self lights up with absolute fear or rage, but the threat doesn't go away. Maybe it's a chronic situation, like an abusive childhood or living in a war zone.
The alarm is always on.
The alarm is always on. The system gets stuck. The core self gets locked into a very narrow regime, either constant hyperarousal where you're always panicked, or total shutdown where you're just numb.
And this leads to dissociation. I've always thought of dissociation as a malfunction, like a glitch in the matrix, a bug in the software.
The paper argues it's not a malfunction at all. It is protective deintegration.
Protective deintegration. Okay.
Think about it. If your core self is screaming terror, pain, death, allowing that signal to reach the autobiographical self fully would be completely incapacitating. You would be able to run. You wouldn't be able to make a plan. You'd just freeze.
You'd be paralyzed.
So the interface disconnects. The Penthouse cuts the phone line to the factory floor. It's a survival mechanism.
So you have the story going, I'm walking around, I'm talking to people, I'm doing my job, but you don't actually feel your body.
Exactly. You disconnect the story from the feeling because the feeling itself is too dangerous to experience. It's a brilliant survival strategy in the short term.
But the cost is huge in the long term.
The cost is that you lose the guidance of your own stack. Mm-hmm. You feel empty. You feel unreal. Because the very thing that makes you feel real, that connection to the proto-self, the connection to viability, has been severed. You're a CEO with no data coming in from the company you're supposed to be running.
This explains so much about why traditional talk therapy can fail for trauma, doesn't it? I have friends who've been in therapy for 10 years, and they can tell you their trauma story perfectly, but they still feel awful.
It does. And this is a bold claim in the paper, but a really important one. Insight does not cure depression.
Oof. That hits hard for anyone who has spent years analyzing their childhood.
It's harsh, but it's true. You can sit in a therapist's office and understand exactly why you were traumatized. Your autobiographical self can have the perfect, eloquent narrative. I am this way because of event X in 1998.
Right. I've got it all figured out.
But the core self isn't listening to your beautiful logic. The core self is still stuck in the brainstem, reacting to mitochondrial stress signals from decades ago. You cannot fix a bottom layer problem with a top layer tool.
It's like trying to fix a broken engine by just repainting the car hood.
Precisely. And so the paper suggests a healing order of operations, and it's strictly bottom up. You have to respect the architecture of the stack.
Okay, lay it out for us. What's step one? Where do you start?
Step one, restore metabolic and safety capacity. The body. You have to convince the mitochondria that the war is over.
So this is the really basic stuff.
The foundational stuff. This means sleep, nutrition, reducing inflammation, getting into nature, feeling physically safe in your environment. If your mitochondria are still sending danger signals, no amount of positive thinking is going to help.
Okay, so you stabilize the foundation. What's step two?
Reopen effective signaling. The feeling. This is where all the body-based therapies come in. Things like somatic experiencing, yoga, breath work, massage. You're learning to tolerate bodily sensations again without dissociating.
You're reconnecting the phone line.
You're gently reconnecting the phone line between the factory and the CEO.
And only then, after all that.
Only then do you fix the narrative. Step three is the story. Once the body feels safe and the feelings are manageable, then the story can change. But if you try to rewrite the story while the body is still screaming danger, it won't stick. The brain will just reject the new story because it feels like a lie. It's inauthentic.
That makes so much sense. It really reframes why things like yoga or breath work or even just getting 8 hours of good sleep are actually profound mental health interventions. They aren't just lifestyle tips. They are targeting the proto-self.
They are interface repairs. You're restoring the signaling so the whole stack can finally work together again.
Now, speaking of non-traditional interventions, this is where the paper took a turn I really did not expect. Section 5, we're going back in time to ancient science.
Yes. This, for me, was one of the most intellectually satisfying parts of the whole paper. You have to remember, Dr. Sahili is a Western-trained MD, but he devotes a whole section to rereading traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda through this viability stack lens.
And to be clear, he's not saying magic exists or anything like that. He's saying these were interior sciences.
Correct. Imagine you are a brilliant, observant physician 2,000 years ago. You don't have a microscope. You can't see mitochondria. You can't measure GDF-15 in the blood. But you can feel the results of mitochondrial function. You can feel your own viability. You can track patterns in your patients over years.
So when they talk about these mystical sounding terms, they're actually just describing the feeling of being regulated or dysregulated.
Exactly. Let's take qi or qi, ECM, and prana in Ayurveda. We usually translate these as energy, which makes modern scientists roll their eyes.
Right. They ask what kind of energy? Joules, volts, calories. If I can't measure it with my instruments, it's not real.
It sounds like woo-woo. My energy's blocked. My chakras are misaligned.
Exactly.
But Dr. Sahili suggests we translate qi not as magic energy, but as felt viability flow.
Felt viability flow. Okay, that sounds much more scientific.
It's the subjective experience of adaptive responsiveness. When you have high qi, it means your stack is aligned. Your mitochondria are producing plenty of energy. Your signals are clear. You feel capable of meeting the demands of your life. When you have stagnant qi, it feels like a blockage.
Like that feeling of, I want to do this thing, but I just can't make myself start. Procrastination.
That's a perfect example. The paper mentions liver qi stagnation. In TCM, this is associated with frustration, anger, feeling stuck. In the viability stack model, that is the felt experience of constrained mobilization.
Unpack that. What does that mean?
It means your body is revving the engine, that's mobilization, your sympathetic nervous system is firing, but the brakes are on at the same time. That's constraint. That creates a very specific and very unpleasant physiological feeling. The ancients called it stagnant liver qi. We might call it sympathetic arousal with behavioral inhibition. They're describing the exact same biological state.
That is fascinating. So they were mapping the interfaces from the inside out while modern science is trying to map them from the outside in.
Precisely. And let's look at yin and yang. Again, often seen as these mystical symbols or just a cool tattoo, but the paper frames them as regulatory regimes.
Regimes, as in modes of operation.
Exactly. Yin corresponds to buffering, conservation, rest, and repair. It's the anabolic state, building up resources. Yang is mobilization, action, expenditure, catabolism.
Yeah.
Breaking things down to create immediate energy.
So if an acupuncturist tells you you're yin deficient, what they're really saying is you've lost your ability to buffer.
You've lost your reserve, you're burnt out, you're all acceleration and no brakes, you are running hot all the time. That's a viability crisis. It's a state of low-grade inflammation and high catabolism. It's not sustainable.
And there's one more set of terms I want to touch on because I thought they were beautiful. Shen and Ojas.
These are beautiful concepts. Shen from TCM and Ojas from Ayurveda, they correspond almost perfectly to what Dr. Tully calls the coherence margin.
The reserve tank.
It's that deep reserve of energy that allows you to have a flexible personality, a sense of grace. Think about when you are well-rested, you're healthy, you're feeling good, someone cuts you off in traffic. What do?
I probably just shrug it off.
Yeah.
Maybe make a joke. In a hurry, buddy. I just move on with my day.
Right. You have high Shen, high Ojos. Your stack has a healthy buffer. You can absorb that insult without breaking. Now imagine you haven't slept in 2 days, you're fighting off a flu, and you just got a stressful email about money. Same person cuts you off.
Oh, I explode. It's road rage. I'm screaming. My heart is pounding. I'm a completely different person.
You explode. Your personality became rigid and reactive because your coherence margin collapsed. The paper argues that these ancient systems were obsessed with preserving Shen and Ojas, preserving that margin, because they knew that without it, the self becomes brittle. The self isn't a fixed thing. It expands and contracts based on your energy reserves.
That connects everything right back to the mitochondria. Mm-hmm. If your mitochondria are weak, so you have a weak proto-self, you have low Shen, and your autobiographical self becomes a jerk.
Exactly. It's all one continuous stack. You can't be a saint with a broken metabolism. It's just not biologically possible.
It's a lot to take in, but it feels incredibly unifying. It's not mind versus body anymore. It's not science versus spirituality.
No, which brings us to section 6, the conclusion. It's the unified architecture.
So let's recap the full picture one more time before we let everyone go and digest this. The unified architecture of the self.
Okay, at the bottom we have the proto-self. The mitochondria deciding what is possible, the can I layer.
The foundation.
Then we have the core self, the brain stem making those decisions felt, the I feel layer.
The alarm system.
And at the top, we have the autobiographical self, the cortex turning those feelings into a life story, the I am layer.
And the big takeaway here, I think the part that hits the hardest emotionally is about reframing responsibility.
This is really the ethical heart of the paper. We tend to judge people and ourselves based on this assumption that we always have free will. That we can always just choose to be better. We judge the addict, the depressed person, the burnt out employee.
Why don't they just get it together?
Right. But the paper says agency isn't a constant. It's not a fixed trait.
It's a variable.
It fluctuates based on your coherence margin. If your stack is healthy and robust, you have high agency. You can choose to be kind when you feel angry. You can choose to work when you feel a little tired. But if your stack is collapsed, if your GDF-15 is sky high, if your core self is locked in a trauma response, if inflammation is rampant, your agency shrinks. Your options literally disappear.
So compassion isn't just being nice, it's biological realism.
Precisely. You cannot demand high-level agency from someone with a collapsed viability stack. It's like demanding a car drive at 60 miles per hour when it has an empty gas tank.
Yeah.
It's not stubbornness. It's not a moral failure. It's physics, or in this case, it's biology.
That really changes how I look at people I might have called lazy or difficult, or even just how I look at my own bad days. It's not a moral failure. It's a stack failure.
And the solution isn't judgment. It's restoration. Restore the stack from the bottom up, and the agency returns on its own.
So we've climbed the mountain, we've gone from the mitochondria to the soul, basically. And I want to leave our listener with a final thought, a provocation to take with them. Dr. Taheli says the self isn't a noun, it's a verb. It's life regulating itself. So here's my question to you, listening right now. Which layer of your stack is driving the bus today? Are you listening to the story, the CEO in the penthouse saying, everything is fine, just keep pushing? Or are you listening to the viability signals, the factory floor quietly, or maybe not so quietly saying, we need to stop?
It's the most important question you can ask yourself. Because if you ignore those silent partners, the mitochondria, for too long, eventually they will make you listen. And they have a veto power that you absolutely cannot override.
And on that cheerful but necessary note, thank you for taking this deep dive with us. Respect your mitochondria, folks. They're working hard down there.
They certainly are.
We'll see you next time on the Deep Dive.